been working on an algorithm for doing radiative transfer. So just a quick overview. First, I want to just convince you all that radiation is important in astronomy and astrophysics. Then I'm going to give you a bit of a background on our code base and specifically part of the gravity of our code base, because we're going to be borrowing from that. Then we're going to go into the actual, our actual algorithm we've been working on and show some tests of it, and then, of course, where we're heading with it. Now, radiative transfer, why is it important? Well, when we look up, this is what we see. We see photons, we see light, we see, that's what we know about our universe, is what photons come to us and tell us about. This is specifically the Rosette Nebula, and at the center of it is what's called a Strongen sphere, or an H2 region. It's an area of ionized hydrogen that's been ionized by a cluster of O and B type stars, so very large stars that send out a lot of UV radiation. And this is NGC 604. It's very similar. It's another H2 region. And it's very important to look at these objects and realize that there are, it's not just photons coming to us, but there's photons going out. They're ionizing the gas. They're heating the gas. Sometimes the gas emits photons to cool. As well, the chemical status of the gas changes because of, UV photons dissociating molecular gas or ionizing gas. Because of the heating and cooling, you can change the star formation that's happening within those clouds. So radiative transport is very, very important in astrophysics. Now, modeling it, despite it being very important, is very, very difficult. It's a seven-dimensional problem by nature. So you've got three positions, two angles, and then time and the frequency band that you're looking in. And so if you want to do an accurate scheme, you're looking at a very, very heavy computational cost. So much so that most simulations, most astrophysical simulations these days, either if they're doing radiative transfer, they have to scale down their simulation quite a bit, or they have to do it after the simulation has already run just to get kind of a nice picture or get an idea, afterwards. Now, most accurate methods use what's called ray tracing, where you literally send out rays of photons, and these get diminished as they encounter gas along their path, essentially simulating absorption, or not generally scattering, but absorption. And this gives you, this is good for what's called optically thick and optically thin regimes, where you've got optically thin, you're traveling along, not much light is being absorbed, or optically thick, lots is being absorbed. And it gives you really good angular resolution. Usually these are Monte Carlo, and they send out rays in random directions, and you have to send out lots and lots of rays to get, that good angular information. But it gives you really bad scaling with the number of sources that you've got that are sending out light, because you've got to send out rays for every single source. It's also pretty much impossible to do scattering, because as you go out, you generally want to travel along with that one ray to find out how long it how much it diminishes. You can't then change direction and follow that one as well. It just becomes too expensive. If you're in a very optically thick regime, then flux-limited diffusion is another method that becomes a possibility. Essentially, you're just diffusing the radiation throughout your gas. And that gives you not very good angular information, but it's pretty good scaling with the number of cores, because everything, essentially, you've just got a sea of photons bouncing around inside your gas, and you can just propagate that around without worrying about too much where they came from. Now, there are other assumptions that have been made by people, lots of other methods to try to save on computational costs. Just as an example, one method that we read about recently, just looks at the source and the sink, looks in the area right nearby, and diminishes the photons right in those areas and ignores everything in between. Now, it didn't work very well, because there is usually quite a lot of stuff in between. So as you can see, there is a big market for cheap radiative transfer that still has, half-decent accuracy. Now, a lot of the cosmological codes I mentioned, they have to be scaled down to run them, or the other option sometimes is that they either ignore it, or they just set a whole, a constant background radiation field to kind of represent, a constant heating rate or something like that, so your gas can't cool down too much. And other codes to simply add some, thermal or kinetic energy to the gas to represent light heating that gas. So let's get to our code and our algorithm. Now, we've been working with a code called Gasoline. The algorithm is not specific to Gasoline, but that's what we've been using, so that's what our results will be presented from, is results from Gasoline. Now, Gasoline is what's called a tree SBH code, SBH for smooth particle hydrodynamics. It's good for doing hydrodynamics. And the tree part refers to the gravity solver in it, which is a uses what's called a KD tree or a K-dimensional tree. And all that means is it's an efficient way of representing positions in space, in memory. And so you can get information from that, like nearest neighbors and things like that, quite efficiently. You can also interact with different part levels of the tree to get, you know, more or less efficient interactions. I'll explain a little more on that in just a second. Now, Gasoline also includes a lot of other physics, such as, well, we've got hydrodynamics and gravity, which I mentioned, but also star formation and lots of other subgrid models that approximate what's happening in the gas. Now, we're going to be borrowing from the gravity tree in Gasoline for our radiative transfer algorithm because it is quite efficient. Gravity generally runs and scales as order n log n, where n is the number of resolution elements in our simulation. Now, what I've shown here, this is not my favorite image, but that's all I had at the time. This is essentially what a, I'm going to use the hockey stick, it's playoffs, so, you know, got to stay in the spirit. So this is essentially what a KD tree would kind of look like, and I'll show a slightly better image in just a second, where these black dots are particles, and typically there would be many, many more particles, many in each one of these cells. And as you look actually in memory, this is represented kind of like, well, a drawing of what it would look like in memory, like a tree. You're branching at each level, and at each level, you represent a larger point portion of the volume. So up here, you've pretty much got the whole box, and then as you go down, you split the box into two pieces, then you split this piece into two pieces, and you keep going. Okay, so that's the idea behind, just the very, very basic idea behind a KD tree. Now, when you're doing gravity, you can typically ask the question, if I'm some particles in one of these boxes that we split up, for example, C, and I want to know what the gravity on these particles is from this box over here, you can define what's called an opening radius. And if you are further away than this opening radius, like C is, then you can just say, well, I'm just going to interact with the moment of mass in this whole box rather than with every single particle in the box. And you save a whole bunch of computations. Now, for A and B, these ones are within the opening radius, and so they would need to actually get more specific information about this box, or if there isn't any, you know, lower levels in the tree, then it would have to actually just do the n squared calculation of between each particle. Now, we can do essentially the same thing for radiation because when there's no absorption, radiation is essentially the same. It's, you know, a 1 on r squared kind of diminishing of flux. And so what it would sort of look like schematically is here is our simulation volume, and here's our different cells that we've split it into. Over here, we want to know what the flux is due to some stars over here. Now, we could get the flux of each star individually, or we can sort of accumulate them to get a center of luminosity, essentially the moment of luminosity, and send just one kind of one average flux over this way with a sort of accumulated luminosity and then a 1 on 4 pi r squared to diminish it. And that works really well. But unfortunately, what do we do if there's absorption, if there's something happening in between the center of luminosity and this cell right here? And in general, that's almost always going to be the case. So we need to adapt this to account for absorption. So I mentioned earlier optical depth, and this is what I'm talking about. When there's absorption, we say that there's a higher optical depth, and if there's a lot of absorption, you say it's optically thick. Essentially, to get that, you need to do an integral between over rho, which is just density, kappa, which is essentially a measure of how much something absorbs light as it passes through it, and then ds, which is just your path length. So if you're going further, then it's just ds ends up being much larger. And then all you simply do is diminish it by e to the minus tau, where tau is that optical depth we just calculated. So really, the goal here is to get some estimate of tau between our source and our sink. So I'm going to show you a little animation here. Do I have a mouse on this? Maybe not. Oh, there we go. Thank you. Okay. So the idea is that we've still got all this information from the tree that we can use. All we have to do is actually sort of head back up the tree. And I'll show you what I mean here. So we start trying to get the center, the flux from this cell in the corner down to here. Now we start in this cell and we say, okay, we've got some average density and some average kappa in this cell, and we've got some distance in this cell. So we can record a row, a kappa, and a distance. So we do that up here. Now when I step up the tree, I get a larger volume. And this row 2, kappa 2 represents this box here because we can figure out what this one is from that one. But that doesn't actually add anything to this path, so we ignore it. And then we go up again. This one, again, doesn't add anything. We go up again. This one adds another line segment. And so we add another line segment, rho and kappa. And then we keep going. We go up, up. And now we contain both particles in this entire box, and so we stop. And so then we start from the other side to get as best information as we can about over here. So again, we get that little piece, we go up, get that little piece, and now we've got the whole path. Now the bonus, the big savings you see here is that as you keep going up the tree, you get larger volumes, and so you get larger line segments. And so you're essentially saying, I'm only interested in the fine detail near the source, but I would still like to know information in between the source and the sink. It just doesn't need to be as detailed. And so you get that information, and then you just simply sum up all the segments into a tau and then do your normal flux and diminish it. And what that allows you to do is to take big groups of with many sources, combine them all, and then diminish it over a large distance. And that saves you a lot of computation. So when you walk back up the tree like that, I was showing, that adds another log n to your original n log n scaling. And so you end up with roughly n sink, log n source, log n total scaling, which turns out to come out somewhere around gravity in terms of runtime, about the same cost. Now you can adjust your accuracy with that opening angle criteria I was telling you about, with that R open we talked about earlier. If you make it larger, then you typically check more cells with the n squared calculation, so you pay more, computational expense, but you get better accuracy. The method naturally gives you better resolution near the source and near the sink, and that's what you want. It can also handle a lot of sources, which is really a really important thing to this, because most algorithms can't. That's where most algorithms fall down. Now we can also do a test, and I'll just show you a quick demonstration of what we've got so far by just coupling this radiation to the ionization code so you can see if things are happening properly, because if you're getting the right number of photons, then you should be ionizing the correct number, the correct amount of gas. And so we're doing what's called a Strömgen sphere. I mentioned that earlier that we had a region called a Strömgen sphere where you have an ionizing star at the center, and you send out photons and you ionize a sphere of gas around you. And that has a nice analytic solution that we can compare to. And so this is just an animation of that happening. Here is a slice through a simulation. It's just uniform gas at a uniform temperature. And you can see, I know the contrast isn't great on this, but you can see the blue means it's totally ionized, red means it's totally neutral. And so you can see it propagates out, and currently it's ionizing a little bit too much, but again, it's still early, so we're gonna fix that. This is just the same thing. This is H2 ionized, and this is H1. So you can see the radius is where it crosses over is a little too far. And then here's our flux, which should be 1 over r squared inside because it's totally ionized, and so there's no gas absorbing the light. And outside, it should be in sort of e to the minus tau fall off. And then for reference, this is that original Rosette nebula that we looked at earlier, and you can sort of see the same region here is developing here. Okay. So I'll just wrap up by saying thanks to my advisors, James Wadsley, Hugh Couchman, and collaborators, Charlotte Christensen, and of course, Compute Ontario. And I'll leave my conclusions and future work up on that you can ask me about if you'd like. Thank you.
So you mentioned that the algorithm works with cosmological sources, but can the machine apply to the measure of binary stars?
Yeah, so it would work with binaries. So do you mean just to apply it to
binary transport paths? So SPH is used in a wide range of phenomena.
Right, yeah.
Many people use it for studying interaction between either black hole, the different kind of stars, or binary stars.
Mm-hmm.
So I was wondering, in some particular cases, it may be interesting to see which kind of radiation you're actually getting from a main sequence, it's a white hole, whatever kind of final you want to play.
So the original goal of this was just to be good enough essentially to do, you know, cosmology. We've got some stars, you know, scattered throughout our universe. We want to get somewhere around, you know, 10% accuracy, something like that. But we did this, we ended up doing the Strongman sphere and getting pretty good results. If you were doing a really, I feel like you'd need pretty good angular resolution to do something like two stars interacting like that. And I don't know if this would work so well.
So in your simulations, each particle represents a star?
The one that I showed you, pretty much everything was a gas particle. Like all these are gas particles, and at the very center is a single star particle. But that, so that this was just to make sure that the essentially the radio, things were being
like
done properly.
Simulation.
Sorry?
It's more like an iron body simulation.
I'm still sorry.
It's more like an iron body simulation, more than like SPH, right?
Because yeah, sorry. So SPH is actually turned off here. Yeah.
Okay.
So this is because if once you start moving the gas, then the analytic solution doesn't apply anymore. And so if you assume the gas is not, or the radiation is not actually pushing the gas, then you can get a nice analytic solution. And so that's what this is doing. Now you can easily couple that if you can couple the radiation pressure to the force calculation and then, you know, go with that. It's just for checking though, for comparison.
Very interesting.
We have done testing with multiple stars, and typically we do get that less than 10% accuracy. So I just didn't have any nice stuff to show.
Okay, so let's keep going. So the next talk is by Stephen.